Welcome back to Juno Afternoon. I'm Rhonda McBride. Thank you for being here with us today. The National Wildlife Federation is traveling the country asking hunters and fishers about impacts of climate change. Adam Kendall, Director of Sporting Advocacy for the Federation, is touring Southeast Alaska this week, and he will be holding a roundtable tonight at the Alaskan Hotel and Bar from 6 to 8. I talked with him on Tuesday when he was in Sitka, holding conversations there. I asked him about what the philosophy is behind these conversations.
Yeah, the philosophy is that hunters and fisher people, you know, people who hunt and fish, tell stories, and they share that with their community, and they see things that a lot of folks just don't get to see, right? When you are someone who visits a landscape year after year, and you intimately are involved with that landscape via, you know, trying to pursue fishing game on that landscape, you get an understanding of that place that's hard to do without that. And so you know intimately what's going on there, and you see changes over time. You know, the salmon runs here fluctuate, they go up and down. You talk to any fisherman around here, they're going to know this year was good, this year was bad, and have some theories about why that was. So we're really trying to take that, you know, that field knowledge and help people utilize that to advocate for the things we want to see.
So you're talking basically about citizen science, tapping citizens' observations. And so you've been doing this around the country. And what are you hearing about climate change? Are there any general observations, similarities in what people are telling you?
That's a great question, Rhonda. And I think the answer is yes. And I think the biggest thing that we observe is that people say things are just different. Maybe they can't pin it, but they say, you know, it's just not quite like it used to be for one reason or the other, depending on where they are in the country. Where I'm from in Colorado, we're seeing things like in the fall, the snow doesn't stay on the ground until later in the fall than it did, you know, just a couple decades ago, sometimes 2-3 weeks later. In the spring, it melts earlier. Those kinds of things, if you can imagine, for like water supplies and animal behavior and things like that, that's going to alter the way those things happen. So it doesn't really matter where we go. There's always some folks there that are saying, you know, things are different and here's how, and they have their own stories about how that's changing.
Well, you need that snowpack to keep the ground moist in the heat of summer, so you're less vulnerable to forest fires and things like that. So, you know, I know in Southeast, they are predicting that we will have more rain and less snow, which affects the snowpack and its protective benefits that it brings us. So there's a lot of changes everywhere. So what is it that you want to know about Southeast?
Yeah, we want these authentic stories from people in all of these communities, because we want a couple of things. We want them to engage, and we feel like when you get around in a group and you start talking about what you've seen, it kind of substantiates. A lot of hunters and anglers and people like that are quiet people. They go and they do their thing in the woods, and they don't necessarily run around and talk about it, right? But they'll sit around their community around a fire or something, and they'll talk about it. So the more you get people talking, the more you start going, I've seen that too. Or, you know, that's weird. I wonder what we could do about that. And you really just incite conversation. And then through that, you take those folks and you start designing, hey, what would we do about it if we have, you know, XYZ problem on the landscape? And that's good just for all natural resources issues, whether it's climate change or sustainable forestry or salmon issues. You get folks talking who know these resources really well, and you're going to get better outcomes than if we don't utilize their voices. And the other part, Rhonda, is that this stuff's starting to happen. You're seeing investment in climate smart technology. You're seeing investment in what we call natural infrastructure and nature-based solutions. And that's basically using the landscape and natural services themselves to help restore ecosystems. So, you know, restoring forests, restoring a degraded stream. The stream's messed up and you come and you put it back, maybe salmon return and other birds and wildlife. And that is an ecosystem service that often pays another dividend by protecting, for instance, built infrastructure. If you have a healthy stream, you're not going to have the same chance of flooding downstream and bridges and roads and towns that you would if that stream was totally degraded. We're saying, let's fix these places up. Let's use our knowledge to do it. And then that will pay dividends in many different ways.
Well, in Alaska, there is more than just sport hunting going on. People here depend on the land, just like you depend on the grocery store for a large portion of their diet. We have subsistence. And I'm curious, because in Alaska, people who subsist are probably on the front lines of climate change in most cases. You know, in some parts of the state, for example, up north in Gamble and Savunga, where people depend on walrus meat, the ice pack has shrunk. So they have to boat further out to get the walrus, and their hunting is less successful because they need the ice to butcher the animals. So, I mean, that's just one example of many. I mean, this summer, we're seeing a crisis once again on the Yukon River. The King Salmon Run is not coming. The Yukon Kings are the mainstay of the diet. So I don't want to make sports hunting sound like it's a pleasure sport and that it's in a different category than subsistence. But I wonder why the National Wildlife Federation doesn't come here to talk to Alaskans about subsistence.
Yeah, well, we're here to talk about both. And I think, Rhonda, we need that voice that you just mentioned. Absolutely. That's perhaps more important, as you said, right? The folks who need this to survive and thrive are, you know, that's a critical voice that we have to have. And you know, if you're missing out on that, you're literally not putting food in the fridge or the freezer, right? And so that is more dire than ever. And you're right, the farther north you go, the more pronounced these issues are. Here in Southeast, you're a little bit buffered because it's a temperate, really moderated climate, right? With the, you know, you don't get too cold, you don't get too warm, you're pretty moderated. Whereas many other places in Alaska, you're right, there is a lot of huge impacts. I read something the other day that said there's something like 2 or 3 times more acres burning right now than the last 5 or 6 years combined in Alaska. You've got massive wildfire, you've got drought, you've got all kinds of issues across the state. And we absolutely do want to hear from subsistence hunters and anglers and folks who rely on this. Their voice is just as powerful, if not more powerful and important in this conversation than any others.
But aside from the joy of going out and hunting and angling, and of course, what that means to families, there's also the business aspect of this. Are you seeing some businesses concerned about the future? You know, the guides, the lodges. I mean, there's a huge industry, especially in Alaska, built around sports hunting and fishing.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that, you know, we know about climate issues, and this goes across the country, is it creates a lot of extreme events, right? A huge heat wave, for instance, or a huge drought. And one of the things that guides and outfitters rely on is predictability, right? You kind of got to know when the animals are coming in. If you're a hunting guide, or if you're a fishing guide, you need to know when the salmon are coming through. And as those changes over the years, you're getting erratic patterns of behaviors, and that makes that less predictable. And so when they used to schedule folks, that might not work. There's a lot of different things that people who are relying on, whether it's directly like that or the ancillary businesses, like, you know, people who might process those animals for them or transport hunters and anglers. So yeah, there's a lot of different folks that are being impacted by the changes.
Well, we have had cases in Alaska where there's a lot of uncertainty about whether there will be openers for salmon, because some fisheries are mixed stock fisheries. So you have different types of salmon coming in at the same time, and one is threatened and the other is going gangbusters. But because their runs coincide, you can't let fishermen have an opening. And so I'm talking about mainly Cook Inlet, where you have mixed use of the fisheries. You have sport fishing and commercial fishing coinciding. The lodges and people have got people booked probably a year or so in advance, and they're wanting to come, and it doesn't help if there's no fishing opportunity.
Exactly.
Are you seeing those kind of situations more frequently?
Yeah, and if you're talking about countrywide too, Rhonda, that's exactly what we're talking about in the West, in the lower 48. We're starting to see fishing closures where they say you can't even go fish a stream because the water is too hot for cold water species. And those have increased tenfold just in the last handful of years. It used to be you never saw them. Then you started seeing what we call hoot owl restrictions. And that meant just in the afternoon from noon to 5 o'clock, or different states had different times, you weren't supposed to fish these cold water streams. Now there's complete closures. We saw that in Colorado and Montana. There's some voluntary ones in other states. So if you're a guide, a fishing guide in those places, and they just say that stretch of river you make your living on is closed to fishing, you're out. And that kind of thing is really affecting a lot of people.
So you're here in Alaska and you're kind of looking at the big picture of how Alaska fits into what's going on in the rest of the country. So you will be doing some touring and checking out the scene. What have you got in the works for Wednesday?
Yeah, we're talking with commercial fishermen. We're getting out on the landscapes, ourselves. When we're here, we're going to be with a woman who's going to hunt blacktail. Essentially, the whole thing about this trip is talking to people who are on the ground and taking their stories into our world and talking about it on our channels. We represent a lot of hunters and anglers across the country. And so we want to make sure that when we tell our stories, we have as much information from all the different places in the country and from real people seeing the stuff on the ground. That authenticity is really important to our community. You can't fake it, right? If you've never harvested a moose and field dressed a moose, it's going to be pretty obvious in about 2 minutes of conversation with somebody who has. We want those real stories. What's happening? What are you seeing? What's changing? And then we want to try to take those stories and use those to advocate for policies that get us better outcomes for these landscapes, the wildlife, the fish that depend on them.
So you're going to have a discussion inviting people from the Juneau area to come and tell you their stories, their experiences. How is this going to work?
Yeah, so we've got a few different folks from around the, you know, the community lined up to just give a few minutes on what they're seeing to start the discussion. I'll start it off just kind of telling folks why we're here and a little bit of my experience, and then asking those folks to tell a little bit of their stories. And then really what we want to do, Rhonda, is have just a discussion with other folks in the audience. What are you seeing? What do you want to be done about these things? And share a little bit of the broader national picture. What are maybe the opportunities that we can look at to try and improve the situation? There's some things in Congress right now. There's some different policies that have happened that are hopefully going to be helpful. Investments in some cleaner energy, investments in some restoration, different things like that. We can hopefully start to get a little bit of a handle on this stuff. And one of the things that I really like to point to is if we do it right, we have the chance to increase the opportunities to hunt and fish. You know, if we go and restore these degraded landscapes and we reduce emissions, we do other things like that, we can actually improve the opportunity. And that's really the only hopeful way we can look at this, right? Is let's try to make it better and get more fish and wildlife on the ground and get more enhanced and better shape habitat out there.
So I guess in the school of, if you could do just one thing, and we know that we can do a lot of things, but if people could do just one thing from all the things that you've distilled, what would that one thing be?
I would say just go out there and restore a degraded landscape. You know, lots of local clubs do this. If you've got a stream that's in bad shape from whatever on extraction, flood, whatever happened, and you go fix it, every time you do that, you're you know, giving salmon back a spot they've been accessing for thousands and thousands of years. You're making it right for people downstream. You're making it right for the moose and the deer and everything else that relies on it. And if you take something that wasn't providing habitat value for anything because it was so messed up, every little tiny thing you do is pure improvement. I'm hopeful. You know, we have the songbirds. The beautiful thing about the sporting community, hunters, anglers, subsistence folks, is when they take care of that habitat, it benefits so many other species too, that they're not hunting and fishing, right? And we have this awesome history of fixing landscapes, taking care of landscapes, using our dollars to improve habitat. So that's the kind of thing we're looking for. And if I could do one thing, it would be just every community would adopt somewhere that has trouble, because it doesn't take much to find one. There's always someplace that's in trouble, and go take care of it and fix it back up.
Well, you're in a place where people do a lot of that. Many, many projects, restoration projects going on. And it's kind of surprising in a way, because Alaska is sort of seen as the last wilderness, right? But it's feeling impacts.
Yeah, the take-home message is, with all the different impacts, right, we all have to be doing our part to take care of these amazing resources that we were blessed with. So get engaged, you know, that's what I try to tell everybody more than anything. And, you know, when it comes to climate, Alaska's, you know, the more north you get, the more impactful it is. Alaska's 3 degrees already in temperature over the last 30, 40 years. So, and they're predicted to gain more into the future. So things are going to be different. If a place is 3 or 4 degrees warmer, that is different on average. It does change everything.
That's Adam Kindle, Director of Sporting Advocacy for the National Wildlife Federation. I talked with him on Tuesday when he was in Sitka holding conversations with hunters and fishers about the impacts of a warming climate. And he's here in Juneau to do the same thing this evening at the Alaskan Hotel and Bar. The discussion gets underway at 6 o'clock and will run until 8.